A vibra slap is an excellently named percussion instrument that involves a wooden ball suspended above a wood block by a metal tension bar. It makes a terrific sound, kind of like a mega rattlesnake, which, yeah, I mean, vibra slap, it's a pretty accurate name. Welcome to Strong Songs, a podcast about music. I'm your host, Kirk Hamilton, and I'm so glad you've joined me to talk about music made with vibra slaps, vibratones, vibraphones, and just plain old vibrato. Strong Songs is a fully independent show. It is written, researched, and recorded by me, and the only reason I'm able to put in so much time is thanks to everyone who supports the show. If you like Strong Songs, I do hope you'll consider becoming a patron. There are links for that and for making a one-time donation down in the show notes. On this episode, it's time for another edition of Strong Covers. This time we're talking about a pair of cover recordings that, while great on their own, also give a new understanding of and appreciation for the original. I'm excited to dig in, so let's clip on the capo, tune down the Strat, and get to it. Cover songs have long been a good way to get a sense of a given musician or a given band. Seeing what they do with someone else's song is a great way to understand the qualities that make them distinct as artists. On the flip side, a cover recording can also give an interesting new perspective on the original song, and in some cases, a cover's most essential function is to remind listeners of what a great song it was to begin with. Some covers make subtle changes, some covers are less subtle, but they're always instructive in some way. So I've always liked talking about strong covers on Strong Songs, and it's time to do it again with Strong Covers Volume 3. Well, I heard there was a secret. The first volume of Strong Covers, recorded several years ago now, took on a number of the most well-known and transformative covers around, from Jeff Buckley's cover of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah to Aretha Franklin's cover of Otis Redding's Respect. Volume 2 focused on the Beatles, one of the most covered bands in history, breaking down covers of some of their most well-known songs by artists like Earth, Wind & Fire, Ray Charles, and Bobby McFerrin. So now it's time for Volume 3, and this time I'm going to do something similar to Volume 1, though we're going to go a little more in-depth this time. We're going to focus on two covers, each of which took some essential element of the original song and expanded it, changing the musical and emotional proportions of the song in some significant way, and in the process, we're going to spare some extra time for the original recording and the song itself to better enhance our understanding of just what the secondary artist accomplished with their reinterpretation. So let's get right into it, since there's always a lot to cover in this kind of episode, and it never feels like there is enough time. The first cover we're going to be talking about is one of the most famous cover recordings of all time, one that I've gotten no shortage of emails about. In 1967, Bob Dylan released John Wesley Harding, an album that included an evocative, lyrically daring song called All Along the Watchtower.
There must be some way out of here. Say the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief.
It's a remarkable song all on its own, with lyrics that depict a portentous conversation and an ending that's somehow perfect despite hardly being an ending at all.
Outside in the distance, a wild cat did growl. Two riders were approaching. The wind began to howl.
The very next year, in 1968, guitarist Jimi Hendrix recorded his own version of this song, which would go down in rock history. You know how I said some covers make subtle changes and some are less subtle? Hendrix's version definitely qualifies as less subtle.
Some kind of way out of here. Said a joker to the thief.
There is so much to talk about with this cover, which, underneath its one-of-a-kind production sound and guitar virtuosity, remains true to Dylan's original, bringing out even more of the stormy, dreamlike energy that made the song so great in the first place. So the fundamental differences between these two versions of the song are pretty clear, but some of the specifics are cool. Let's start by talking a little bit about the song itself, since it's a really interesting song just from a structural standpoint.
There must be some way out of here, say the Joker to the thief.
Dylan's version is recorded in his typical late 60s style. It's all acoustic, featuring Bob Dylan on guitar and vocals, along with Charlie McCoy on bass and Kenneth Buttry on drums. The final featured instrument, which we can think of as the color instrument, is Dylan's harmonica, which interjects to build the song's intensity in between verses. The song's musical straightforwardness is precisely the thing that allows it to be unusual. It's in the key of C sharp minor, moving between three chords, C sharp minor, B major, and A major, then going back to B, and then back up to C sharp minor to do it all over again. Since we're thinking about directionality this season on Strong Songs, I hope you're hearing that trajectory. It goes down, and then it goes back up. And that's all this song is. Three chords moving down and back up, over and over and over again, churning like a storm in the sky. But the harmony isn't what makes this song interesting, or at least the harmony is tangential to what makes this song interesting. All Along the Watchtower is all about the lyrics and the song form. The song consists of three verses separated by instrumental breaks, and that's it. That extremely stripped-down structure fits really well with what's happening lyrically and supports the song exactly as it is. Dylan introduces two characters, the Joker and the Thief. He gives them each a couple of lines.
No reason to get excited. The thief, he kindly spoke.
And then in the third verse, he zooms out just enough to paint a broader picture and then just leaves it there with so much left unsaid, unseen, and undone.
And this is not our fate.
Before making this episode, I had never actually just sat down and read the lyrics of All Along the Watchtower and thought about them on their own terms. Doing so really illuminated for me how great it is purely as a poem. I really recommend doing that, just sitting down with the lyrics and actually, here, it's not very long. Let me just read you the lyrics. Try to forget the song, forget any of the many renditions of it you've probably heard over the years, forget the versions of it that you were just hearing in this episode. Try to just focus on the words and the images they conjure. And let's get a little atmosphere in here. There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine. Plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it's worth. No reason to get excited, the thief, he kindly spoke. There are many here among us who feel that life's but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now. The hour is getting late. All along the watchtower, princes kept the view, while all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the distance, a wildcat did growl. Two riders were approaching. The wind began to howl. I mean, take it on its own, and it's pretty good, right? There's a reason it's held up as one of Dylan's best, and his version, arranged and performed in such a straightforward musical fashion, works just fine to support all of the things that make the song extraordinary.
Two riders were approaching. The wind began to howl.
There's just such a strong sense of foreboding throughout this song, particularly that ending, as if something terrible is brewing, but we never find out quite what it is. Social commentary, biblical allusion. People have been interpreting and reinterpreting these lyrics since the moment Dylan recorded them. There's so much ambiguity in this song, so much room for the ear of the listener to take hold, that it's no wonder that it's been covered so effectively by so many different artists. To me, whatever their particular meaning, these lyrics conjure feelings of storm and apocalypse, of brewing disaster. And from the very first notes of his own cover, Jimi Hendrix demonstrated that he heard something similar. I mean, listen to this and tell me you don't hear the storm. As wildly different as Hendrix's version is vibe-wise, the instrumentation isn't actually all that changed from the Dylan original. It's still got bass, drums, acoustic guitar, and vocals, with electric guitar subbed in for harmonica as the color solo instrument. Of course, that's no minor substitution. Adding electric guitar to an arrangement is one thing. Adding Jimi Hendrix playing the electric guitar is quite another. So the guitar solos are great, but Hendrix really makes this song his own in a lot of different ways through a number of creative decisions that all taken together really help illustrate how he worked as a guitarist and as a band leader. To start with, there's the key that he played the song in, which is directly related to the way that he tuned his guitar, and both things had a bigger impact on the song than you might think. So going back to the original key, Dylan played the song in C-sharp minor, remember, which is a key that works okay in an open tuning. It works much better the way he played it with the capo up on the 4th fret, but it also works with no capo. You can just play C-sharp minor to B major and down to an open A major. Sounds kind of fine.
There must be some way out of here.
However, if you listen to Hendrix's version, you'll notice a difference compared to the original.
There's too much confusion.
It's in a different key. It's down a half step. Instead of in C sharp minor, he's playing in C minor. So the three chords that he's playing are C minor, B flat major, A flat major. Now, a bunch of you Hendrix heads out there probably already know why he was playing in C minor instead of C sharp minor, that reason being that he really liked to tune his guitar down a half step and play the whole thing in E flat instead of E. That just means that every string on the guitar is tuned down one half step, which relaxes the strings and gets the whole guitar vibrating a little more deeply. So instead of E, A, D, G, B, E, you get E flat, A flat, D flat, G flat, B flat, E flat. E flat is not an uncommon tuning for guitar players, and a lot of the most famous Hendrix recordings were played on his signature Fender Strat tuned down to E flat, a half a step lower than standard tuning. Now, why did he tune his guitar that way? Well, it could be for a lot of different reasons. For starters, it just makes everything a little lower, so that gives the guitar a bigger, slightly fuller sound overall. I tuned my Strat down to E flat while I was learning this song, and I found that it makes a significant difference in how it feels to play the guitar as well. And that wound up being the reason I actually really like playing in E flat. It's hard to articulate and impossible to really demonstrate just with audio, but it makes the strings looser and feel a little slippier, and it makes it easier to bend and shake notes, which Hendrix really liked to do. This is actually the first time that I've spent a while with my Strat tuned to E-flat, and I gotta say, I'm a convert. It feels so good playing with the guitar a little bit looser, and it makes soloing a lot more fun, too. The There is, of course, much more to this arrangement than just Jimmy's guitar playing, however great that guitar playing may be. And while I don't have space for a full-blown recreation of the entire song, since I have another song I also want to talk about, I do want to rebuild the individual elements of this recording for you all, because the arrangement is such a big part of what makes it work. Hendrix's cover was included on his 1968 album Electric Ladyland, with his regular drummer Mitch Mitchell playing the drums, Dave Mason playing acoustic guitar, Brian Jones on percussion, and Hendrix himself playing bass in place of his usual bassist Noel Redding. The whole recording uses a ton of reverb and tape delay to create this echoing dirge feeling. It rocks so hard and it sounds inimitable. You hear a couple of notes from this intro and you know exactly what you're listening to. So I want to get at what makes this all sound so iconic, but before that, let's talk a little bit about that opening rhythmic pattern and how to count it. Because I, for one, counted this intro totally backwards for most of my life. It actually wasn't until I sat down to start working on this episode that I realized that fact. I used to count it like this. Piano 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, but then... whoa. Something would happen right there, and I'd realize that I had it turned around. As I set about learning the parts, I realized how it actually works. I had been counting the riff starting on four, like this. One, two, three, ba-na-na-na-na-na, da-na-na-na-na-na. Which is a pretty reasonable way to count it. In fact, the riff starts on the and of three. So it's a one, two, three, ba-da-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da, which is very different and kind of required rewiring my brain in order to start hearing it that way. And a one, two, three. Three, four, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. And from that point on, it's clear where the downbeat is supposed to be. There's this momentous driving quality to the whole recording. Dylan kind of bounced through that chord progression, but Hendrix and his band crash through it. The acoustic guitar, the liner notes actually have this as a 12-string, but it's acoustic, and we've established I don't have a 12-string, so I used an acoustic. The non-electric guitar plays a heavy pattern. The bass, which remember is played by Hendrix, just plays the same pattern. And Mitch Mitchell hits the drums in just an onslaught through this entire recording. It proved instructively difficult to try to cop some of the sounds from this record on my own. As it turns out, it's harder to get the sounds of 60s records than it is more modern records, since so much of the quality of those recordings is tied to the unusual, quote-unquote, outdated equipment on which it was recorded. So I can't really quite get the sound of those old tape recorders or of the unusual techniques they use to get overdubbed parts, since it's almost too easy for me to make music here in the year 2024. But I can definitely say that a big part of the sound of this recording and of that stormy atmosphere is tied to delay, specifically tape delay, I think, but really just to the delay effect, which really just means you take a signal and then run it through a delay, which causes the signal to echo one or more times at a certain interval after the original sound. If you listen closely to the recording, you can hear two of almost everything. It's clearest to me with the drums. The drums are panned a bit to the right, but every time Mitch Mitchell hits the snare drum, you can hear a second snare drum fire off a bit to the left. You hear it? It's an interesting approach that I don't hear that much in modern music, just throwing almost the whole kit into a delay like that, but it makes a huge difference. I mean, it's the difference between this and this. It's It's also a cumulative thing. There's delay on the drums, on the vocals, on the percussion, and the more delay you add, the more those secondary repeating tones begin to crash into one another in the mix, creating denser and denser atmosphere. Common wisdom says to be judicious with time-based effects like delay and reverb, but I don't know, this recording doesn't really strike me as judicious in that respect, and you can't say it doesn't work.
No reason to get excited. The
one instrument in this intro that really makes use of the delay is that woodblock, or maybe it's a vibraslap, some sort of bright percussion sound that plays at the outset, almost like a castanet. It's just one hit, I think anyways, but the delay turns it into a cascade. I don't actually have a vibraslap or whatever instrument that actually is, so I did my best. Percussionist Brian Jones added a second crucial instrument to this recording as well. It's one that I always try to call out when I can, since it's consistently one of the most mighty instruments in a given band, despite its small size, and that is the tambourine, which you can hear panned over with the drums over on the right, and which carries the groove throughout the entire recording.
There must be some kind of way out.
The last thing we gotta add is Jimmy himself. It was a lot of fun to try to learn these guitar parts, even just sort of learn them, but I won't spend too long on that process here since I recently talked a bunch about Jimi Hendrix on the show. If you do want to hear more about his distinct style, the challenges of transcribing his solos, check out the episode from season 5 about strong electric guitar solos. I talk about his famous 1967 solo on Hey Joe. Needless to say, it continues to be a great challenge to learn to play along with him, and every time I do, I'm struck by how hugely influential he was and how much Jimmy you can hear and feel in the playing of every great rock soloist who came after him. Just one of those things where it seems like it wouldn't be hard, but then to get his particular time feel to groove with his confidence, it's really, really hard. It's just so difficult to play like Jimmy. And that's just talking about his solos. Hendrix's playing on the verses here is just as inimitable and harder to do if you're trying to sing, though I think he recorded this guitar part separate from the vocals. Hendrix's guitar playing had a lot of little Hendrixisms, and one of them was that he would plant himself in one place and then play little embellishments on top of that planted bottom note. His famous intro solo on Little Wing, incidentally also tuned down to E flat, that has this kind of thing all over it. He'll plant, and then he'll embellish. Plant, and embellish. My teacher Scott calls those flowers, which I really love. Whenever Jimmy does that, he says Jimmy's planting flowers. You see the flowers? On the verses of All Along the Watchtower, Hendrix is constantly planting these beautiful little flowers in the spaces between his vocal phrases. If you listen for it, you'll hear him play something after almost every vocal phrase. The first one's killer. Here's another one. Here comes another. And one more. There's so much improvised ingenuity in Hendrix's accompaniment of his own vocals on every recording he ever made. It's perhaps an underappreciated aspect of his mastery of the guitar. And I mean, that makes sense when you look at how groundbreaking his lead parts were. I mean, come on. But as great as those leads are, I actually find his playing on verses to songs to be harder to emulate and much more idiosyncratic. Like with most things Jimmy-related, you could spend a lifetime chasing down the particulars and never quite play it like he did.
No reason to get excited. The thing kind of is full.
With that being said, for all of Hendrix's embellishments, he's actually staying pretty true to the general groove and arrangement of the original recording. Dylan's version is acoustic, but it too features what I call a pop-forward groove, as Kenneth Buttrey plays all four downbeats on the snare drum, rather than playing a backbeat with the snare drum on 2 and 4.
No reason to get excited. The thief he kindly.
Just a 1, 2, 3, 4. Pop,
there
pop,
are many
pop,
here
pop.
Among us who feel that life is but a joke.
Compare it to what Mitch Mitchell played on the verses, and it's not actually all that different.
The
biggest change that Mitchell makes compared to the original is during the instrumental breaks. On Dylan's original, as he takes his harmonica solos, Buttrey's groove remains steady. Mitch Mitchell, on the other hand, he plays that groove during the verses, but when it's time for Hendrix's guitar solo, he goes for something different, unleashing a wide-open rock groove. It's an important change since it adds a lot more dynamism and structure to the arrangement and helps set the instrumental breaks further apart from the verses.
No reason to get excited.
The last thing that I want to mention is Hendrix's singing, which is another aspect of his artistry that sometimes gets overshadowed by his guitar playing. I think Jimi Hendrix is a wonderful singer. I love his voice. He had this rich, deep instrument with a powerful growl in his upper register and just so much character. He was always somewhere between a blues holler and a croon, like he was talking to you. There's this intimacy in his voice, but he was also kind of just singing to himself, and we were just getting to hear it.
There are many here among us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I have been through that, and this is not our fate.
His singing provides a lot of the emotional contour of this cover, and it makes for a very different energy on some of the song's most famous lines. Like when the thief says, "No reason to get excited," Jimmy gets excited.
No reason. To get excited, the thief he kindly spoke.
We're near the end of the song when the wind begins to howl. I wouldn't dream of trying to cop Hendrix's vocals on my own or recreate them for you or anything, but I did want to mention them since, like I said, I think his singing is a big part of what makes this cover work so well, and I really like Jimi Hendrix's singing in general. All right, so let's try to put that all together, all of the new elements that Jimi Hendrix is introducing to this cover to make it sound distinct. That driving acoustic guitar pushing its way through Dylan's chord progression, the bass doubling it down the octave, those crashing drums slapping back with the stereo tape delay, playing a steady pop-forward groove on the verse just like the original before opening up into an unleashed rock groove on the guitar breaks. That clacking woodblock or vibraslap sound punctuating the intro riff before Jones transitions to a pulsating tambourine and Hendrix's down-tuned strat wailing its first entrance above it all before transitioning to his flower-planting approach to ornamenting and accompanying his vocal lead. It's a real transformation of the song, and I gotta say, this was a really fun challenge. Ears on, here we go. There's something unusual about every single part of this cover, which is a good reminder of how new this all was in the late 60s. Multi-track recording, tape delay, electric guitar solos. There was no agreed-upon best way to do this stuff, which resulted in a lot of interesting experimentation and some pretty amazing recordings. It's just not 1968 anymore, so try as I might, I can only get so close to the original. The remainder of this recording is a bit of a Jimi Hendrix tour. You get a lot of the textures and voices that Jimmy could use the guitar to conjure. There's this nice sliding chordal ambiance. There's a perfect use of the wah pedal halfway through, which really changes the whole character of his guitar playing. And as virtuosic and creative as Jimmy's playing is, the song still remains underneath it all. Dylan's haunting lyrics and storming cyclical song form, providing a platform for Jimmy to make his own musical statement. There are, of course, many more covers of All Along the Watchtower out in the world. It's surely among Dylan's most covered songs. And while Hendrix's cover is arguably the most well-known, the song has turned up so many different places. Dave Matthews does a memorable cover that significantly changes the overall flow and feel of the song. I've seen them do this live. They usually do it as an encore, and it always kills. And of course, when nerds like me hear this song, we can't help but think about its role in a certain infamous reveal on Ron Moore's Battlestar Galactica remake, which began with characters spontaneously uttering lyrics from the song.
Some kind of way out of here. Said the Joker to the thief.
And culminated in the most ominous group humming scene I think I've ever seen. If you haven't seen the show, you don't really know what's going on here, but if you know, you know.
All right, that's enough, goddammit!
It's an amazing song. Honestly, at this point, it's part of the firmament of American popular music. But as much as the song lends itself to reinterpretation and as many great covers as there have been, there's just something special and unquantifiable about Hendrix's version. Learning this cover really helped me understand how thoroughly Jimi Hendrix defied categorization. Music critics and even music listeners love to put music in a box to categorize songs by genre, blues, folk, rock, pop. But American music, and really music in general, it just doesn't work that way. If you had to call this music something, you just gotta call it by his name. This is Jimmy music. Some covers, including many that I've covered on Strong Covers in the past, eclipse the original recording in the public consciousness and become definitive, or at least arguably definitive, versions of the song. The second cover I'm going to talk about, though, is an interesting one because it isn't really like that. It significantly reimagines the original, but it does so in a way that, for me at least, really just serves to emphasize qualities that were already present. And while it's a great cover on its own, for me at least, it served even more as a way to better understand and appreciate the original song in the original recording. As a result, this analysis will actually spend more time on the original than on the cover, though the cover is still an important piece of the puzzle. Let's begin then with that original recording, a song that makes itself known from the very first guitar notes. And if you don't get it from the guitar, you'll definitely get it from the vocals.
Jolene, 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 I'm begging of you, please don't take my man.
Dolly Parton's Jolene, written in 1973, Jolene, apparently on the same day that she wrote previous Strong song I Will Always Love You, is easily one of the singer's most famous songs. And if you listen for 3 seconds, it's pretty easy to see why.
Beyond compare, with flaming locks of auburn hair, with ivory skin and eyes of emerald green. Your smile is like a breath of spring, your voice is soft like summer rain, and I cannot compete with you, Jolene.
Lyrically, musically, vocally, it's a one-of-a-kind song, which of course can become almost a kind of challenge to other musicians. Whom among you would dare to try to cover Jolene, and who could actually make this song their own?
I can easily understand how you could easily take my man, but you don't know what he means to me, Jolene.
Of course, there have been plenty of covers of Jolene over the years, far more than I've ever listened to. Just last week, Beyoncé released her own cover of Jolene, which makes some really interesting and provocative changes. I made this episode and published to the Early Access Patreon feed before that cover came out, so as strong and worthy of analysis as Beyoncé's cover is, it'll just have to wait for a future edition of Strong Covers. Of course, there have been other covers that have put interesting personal stamps on the song, and each one provides a new angle from which to better understand and appreciate the original. The cover I'll be focusing on for this episode arrived almost 30 years after Jolene was first recorded. And then reached its cathartic apotheosis a few years later on stage in England in 2004. That was when the White Stripes, Meg White on drums and Jack White on guitar and vocals, would record and later perform a cover of Jolene that significantly reimagined the feel and overall musical qualities of the song while staying true to its plaintive, emotionally raw core.
You still take him, even though you can.
The Stripes' stripped-down, hard-hitting version really serves to make me understand some things about the original, namely how little stylistic differences matter with a song this good.
Now I can easily understand how you could easily take my man, but you do not know what he means to me.
Really, the White Stripes cover just makes explicit a fact that becomes retrospectively obvious.
Well, you could have your chosen man, but I could never love again.
Even in its original acoustic iteration, Jolene packs a punch.
You could have your choice of men, but I could never love again. He's the only one for me, Jolene.
So let's talk about why that is and how, by stripping the song even further down to its basics, Jack and Meg White helped reveal the exposed nerves and fiercely beating heart of this incredible song. Let's start with the music, and then we can get into the lyrics and the way this song tells its story and the way that the White Stripes helped refocus the nature of that story. To start with, we gotta talk about that one-of-a-kind guitar part. Jolene is a quintessential 1970s Nashville record. It was produced by storied country producer Bob Ferguson, and man, it sounds so good, precise and specific, just brimming with musicality, performed with a subtle but inimitable feel. The song's heart beats through that guitar part, or really that pair of guitar parts, which I will always think of as maybe the best ever example of the power of finger-picked acoustic guitar.
I'm begging of you, please don't take.
I mean, just listen to it. I very rarely seek out isolated tracks when I'm making this show, but as I researched Jolene, and in particular these guitar parts, I came across this one. By most accounts, Jolene was recorded by Nashville session guitarists Chip Young and Wayne Moss, with Young playing the main bouncing gut string part on the right, and Moss on the sympathetic spangly steel string part, which is panned to the left. This isolated track is floating around online in a few places, but I first heard it on the YouTube channel of guitarist and music historian Zach Childs, who had tracked down Wayne Moss to ask him about who played the part back in 1973. In the process, Zach Childs also got access to the original master, the 16-track master, where he could hear those guitar parts in isolation. When Childs asked him about the session, Wayne Moss said that it was him and Chip Young. That's extra helpful because, at least with with my vinyl pressing of this album, which is also called Jolene, there aren't any personnel credits, there's just production and engineering credits. And Chip Young, in an older interview uploaded to YouTube by the Musicians Hall of Fame and Museum, he says the same, that it was him and Moss. He also tells a funny story about how Parton showed them the song and was somehow able to play it despite the amazing nails on her fretting hand.
You know, when she showed us that song, she had fingernails. Golly, dog, they must have been that long. And she was playing that thing, and those old nails would hang out. I said, how are you making a chord with those nails? I don't know. I'm just getting my fingers down on the strings. But she, I mean, of course, I came up with that. Me and Wayne Moss. Wayne played, he's playing something else. I learned that from Joe South, but he used to play it. Played in the major, and I tried.
I recommend checking out that interview too. I've linked to both of those videos in the show notes. And if you caught that, Young mentioned getting the idea for the guitar pattern from Joe South, who was another Nashville guitarist and songwriter. And I gotta say, I didn't expect to fall down any kind of a rabbit hole about this guitar part. I figured it would be pretty established who played it, but I really feel the benefit of other folks who went much further down the same rabbit hole. I do want to express my appreciation for them, for people who have taken the time to document and upload this record of who played this part and who inspired it, because it's an incredible guitar part. It's been listened to by millions, if not billions, of people at this point, and the identities of the guitarists who inspired and then came up with and recorded the parts could easily have been lost to time. The whole thing really makes me think about how much music history really does just get lost to time, and I guess that's just history. We do our best and we preserve what we can.
Talks about you in his sleep, and there's nothing I can do to keep from crying when he calls your name, Jolene.
So as for the particulars of that guitar part, I haven't learned both Young and Moss's parts, so I'll just focus on that main, most famous part, which is played on a gut string guitar, which is why it has that slightly muted sound. I don't have a gut string guitar, I just have a steel string. We will make do. Furthermore, I believe Young is using a thumb pick on this, which is a pick that wraps around your thumb and allows for more percussive bass notes when finger picking. I don't play with a thumb pick, so I'll just be picking with my regular old thumb. This guitar part is a variation on what's called Travis picking, which is named for singer-guitarist Merle Travis. It's a style of playing that involves bouncing your thumb back and forth between the lowest three strings of the guitar while your first three fingers alternate on the first three strings, the higher strings of the guitar. It's a super common style of playing, particularly in country music, and it's a nice way to turn a chord into a bouncing sequence of single notes and pinches where you hit two notes at the same time. I've actually never gotten my Travis picking totally locked in. It's really fun to learn it because it's so mechanical, and learning Jolene for this episode has actually got me on the right track. I took this song into my guitar lesson, and now I am drilling Travis picking, and I'm trying to get it locked in because it's something that any country guitarist can do in their sleep, or, you know, can do while singing a really complicated melody. Once you get the pattern under your fingers, it just becomes automatic, and you can turn a simple strummed chord progression into something much more elaborate and ornate. Young and Moss took that principle and applied it to Jolene, modifying the basic Travis pattern into something a bit groovier and more specific. Jolene is in C-sharp minor, so they've got the capo up on the fourth fret, which allows them to play as though they're playing in A minor and be playing in C-sharp minor. And incidentally, that's the same place that Bob Dylan had the capo when he played All Along the Watchtower, which is also in C-sharp minor. So this is a big episode for Capo on 4. The pattern begins with the B string ringing open, which makes for this really nice C-sharp sus9 sound. I always think of that as the Diablo chord. There's actually no third in this opening chord, though very quickly they hammer on that B string up to an E, which makes for the minor third and just gives you a standard C-sharp minor. And that movement, that hammer on the B string, that's really key to the way this riff sounds. Listen to the actual recording and keep your ears out for that, for the way there's that little pop where they go up from a D sharp to an E. It's so good. It's just got such a bounce to it. So for another parallel, just like All Along the Watchtower, Jolene is only three chords and has no bridge or interlude or anything. It's just C sharp minor, then E major, and then B major before going back to C sharp. But remember that idea of musical directionality? Well, Jolene has all these similarities to Watchtower, but it's actually moving in the opposite direction. All Along the Watchtower swirls down, 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 but Jolene climbs up and up before finally descending. That's a total coincidence, just something I noticed after I started making the episode, but it's kind of cool. Now, Jack White of the White Stripes is both a student and a scholar of the guitar. The guy has forgotten more about guitar history than I'll ever learn, and it's more than likely that he knows the original Jolene part and probably who recorded it and where it came from. But of course, he wasn't interested in totally recreating it note for note for his cover. Instead, he reimagined it into a slightly different place on the guitar, which had all sorts of downstream effects for the way the White Stripes cover works. This is the studio version where everything's just a little easier to make out. So as you're probably hearing, there's something familiar about the guitar part White is playing. It bears some relation to the original guitar part, but it also sounds pretty different from what Young and Moss recorded for Parton back in the 70s. Obviously, for starters, while the studio version does have an acoustic guitar in a secondary role, the primary guitar on this is electric. I'm not sure what kind of guitar it is, but regardless, it is a far cry from a gut string, thumb-picked acoustic. The second notable thing is that White is playing in a different key. Instead of C sharp minor like the original, he's playing in D minor, but he's not using a capo, so he's actually playing in a regular tuning and moving everything up one half step. And again, this is a total coincidence. I swear I didn't pick these two covers because of this, but it's pretty wild that Dylan's song was in C sharp minor, capo on 4, and Hendrix played it with no capo, down a half step in C minor, while Dolly's song is also in C sharp minor, capo on 4, and Jack White played it with no capo, up a half step in D minor. Just a funny coincidence. So to play the song in D minor, you basically just move the whole pattern up one string set using the open D string as the root, and it's actually pretty similar to what Young and Moss were doing. It just feels very different because he's playing with open strings, he's playing with a pick, and he's on an electric guitar, so there's a much more open and loose feel to what he's doing. Also, you heard that right, he's playing in D, so he's a half step higher than Dolly Parton, which means he needs to sing the melody even higher than she did. That vocal performance gets at another huge difference between this cover and the original. Superficially, there's the fact that White, a man, not only sings in a higher key than Parton, which pushes him up into that amazing, tortured upper register strangle scream thing he can do, but he also ditches a long tradition of gender-swapping lyrics to fit the new singer, and he just sings the song the way she sang it, because, I mean, why change it? Yeah. As Parton has told it, Jolene was inspired by a few things. A young fan named Jolene, whose name Dolly thought would make for a good song title and who looked like the Jolene Dolly would later imagine in the song, as well as a time when she felt jealous of another woman shortly after she and her husband were married. Jolene, the song, is notable for a number of reasons, both musically and lyrically. Lyrically, it's remarkable because of how unusual it is for a song of this sort to tell its story in this way. In country music, there's a long tradition of what musicologist Nadine Hubbs calls the other woman song, where the singer confronts the other woman in her man's life, often demeaning and threatening her. Hubbs cites Loretta Lynn's Fist City and Carrie Underwood's Before He Cheats as examples of this song style, but there are loads of them I'm sure you've heard a few. Jolene is certainly an other woman song, but Parton ingeniously flips the whole paradigm on its head. Parton's narrator isn't angry with Jolene, she's in awe of her. The first thing she does is describe Jolene's beauty and acknowledge her power. "I'm begging of you," she says, "please don't take my man." And this song has an interesting, I guess you'd call it the song's emotional imaginary. It's this exaggerated world of emotional truth. The singer's man is essentially a non-factor, and she herself has been rendered completely powerless by Jolene, this outside force.
He talks about you in his sleep, and there's nothing I can do to keep from crying when he calls your name, Jolene.
Later, she sings, "My happiness depends on you and whatever you decide to do." And through it all, she sings beautifully the other woman's name over and over and over. Jolene, Jolene, Jolene.
Choice of men, but I could never love again. He's the only one for me, Jolene.
It's easy to lose sight of this amid the band's bouncing groove and Parton's impeccable vocals, but Jolene's a desperate song with a narrator who's been cornered and left with no choice but to directly address Jolene and hope the other woman chooses mercy. And that, I think, is what the White Stripes cover taps into so well. Parton's precision and control may mask the frantic fear of her protagonist, but Jack White has no compunction about letting that all out into the open. This live recording in particular really rocks, and I haven't talked much about Meg White here, but I do love her drumming, and don't worry, the White Stripes will get their due on strong songs at some point.
Please don't take him, even though you can.
Jack's shrieking vocals and guitar and Meg's crashing drumming make for such a marked contrast with the original that they wind up being pretty complementary. I almost imagine the two versions of the song representing twin truths of the protagonist. Parton's version on the outside, the closely controlled, heartbroken spouse, composing herself for a controlled, semi-public plea.
Jolene, 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 Jolene.
And the Stripes version on the inside, the raging betrayal and heartbreak that would cause a person to make such a plea in the first place.
Jolene, Jolene.
White's vocal performance, in which he raises the key and forces himself to sing even higher than the angel-voiced Parton, reminds me of another alternate version of Jolene, which doesn't quite count as a cover, but that does give new insight into the original recording, similar to the White Stripes version. It's a version I first heard about 10 years ago. It's billed as being a 33 RPM version of the song. It's really just slowed down and down-tuned a fourth from C-sharp minor to G-sharp minor, which significantly changes the feel of the song. It also completely changes Parton's vocal performance, making her sound more in the range of a male tenor.
Jolene, 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 I'm begging of you, please don't.
It's a little bit uncanny, but I've also always found it oddly compelling. You can really hear Parton's gear shifts as she moves through her vocal break.
Jolene, Jolene, Jolene. Take him just because you can.
You can also hear how emotional her performance really is, though she's subtle enough and moving fast enough that it's easy to miss it in the original. Slowed down, you can hear the tears in her voice.
I had to have this talk with you. My happiness depends on you and whatever you decide to do, Jolene.
Just one more lens through which to view the incredible song that is Jolene.
And whatever you decide to do, Jolene.
Whether you're hearing it sung by a full-speed Dolly Parton,
Jolene, 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 Jolene.
Screamed by Jack White,
Jolene, 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 Jolene.
Crooned by slowed down Dolly Parton,
Jolene, 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 Jolene.
Or sung by any of the countless other artists who've covered it over the years, Jolene will remain a song freighted with nuance and subtle emotion that, with its simple chord progression, stripped-down structure, and deeply relatable lyrics, all but begs for creative reinterpretation. And that'll do it for Strong Covers Volume 3. I hope you enjoyed it. This was a really educational one for me across a number of fronts, and I got a lot out of the process of putting it together. I hope I was able to share some of that with all of you. Thanks, as always, to Emily Williams for her production support this season, as well as to Scott Pemberton for his help learning some of these guitar parts and for his general wisdom on the playing of Jimi Hendrix. Scott really knows his stuff. Also, a shout out to Zach Childs for his work uncovering and documenting the proper crediting for Jolene. Definitely check out his YouTube channel, and thanks as well to Nadine Hubbs for her thought-provoking work writing about this song. Finally, of course, thanks to everyone who supports Strong Songs on Patreon. For just $5 a month, basically a cup of coffee, you can meaningfully support the creation of this independent show, and at that tier and higher, you'll also get episodes of the show 2 weeks early, so you could be listening to the next episode of the show right now, and it is a pretty cool episode, I'll just tell you that. Patreon.com/strongsongs, and thanks as well to everyone who's made a one-time donation lately. Those are also very helpful, and there is a link for that in the show notes as well. A little note here for all of you out there with your own musical practice or your own creative projects. I hope those are going well for you. And if you're a listener who has picked up a new instrument or rediscovered an old instrument lately, if you've been feeling your practice routine faltering recently, try to get back to it. Just go back to basics and remember, a little bit every day is better than a lot every few days. All right, that'll do it for me. Thanks as always for listening. I'll be back in 2 weeks with an episode on one of my favorite musicians of all time. Until then, take care and keep listening.